As of today, Ohio has a vacant U.S. Senate seat. Who will Governor Mike DeWine pick to replace Vice President-elect J.D. Vance? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll talk politics in Ohio and Kentucky, snow business in Greater Cincinnati, and we'll hear a postmortem on the Bengals' disappointing season. Joining me now to get us started, our Kentucky Lantern reporter, McKenna Horsley. Welcome back, McKenna.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent, Sarah Donaldson. Thanks for being here, Sarah.
Always good to be on.
Sarah, as I mentioned, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance resigned from his Senate seat. Everybody's kind of waiting for that to happen. Has Governor DeWine given any indication who he might appoint?
Governor DeWine has kept his cards pretty close to his chest for months about who he might appoint to the seat. Of course, this became a possibility back in July of last year. And back then he was saying, oh, well, you know, Trump and Vance have to win an election first. And so, of course, that happened. He's kind of set out the criteria for who he wants. He says he wants someone who can both appeal to voters in a primary election and in a general election, because whomever he appoints in the next couple of days, they're going to have to run for the seat several times. It's not going to be like a traditional U.S. Senate seat where you run and then you're in office for 6 years. They're going to have to run to retain their seat in a special election next year and then again in 2 years. So it's he wants someone who's committed to Ohio, he says, but also who has the wherewithal to, you know, run several times for Senate.
Who's in the running for the seat? Do we know?
So political insiders have said the likely top candidate is Governor DeWine's right-hand man, Lieutenant Governor John Husted. Husted has long been DeWine's favorite for governor to succeed him in 2026 because, of course, Governor DeWine is at the end of his term and someone will need to replace him in the coming year or two. But it sounds like it's his if Husted wants it. However, there, of course, have been a list of other candidates for a while. Vivek Ramaswamy, the former presidential candidate and now Trump appointee to the Department of Government Efficiency, was a more firebrand conservative outsider consideration. And at the end of the day, it's DeWine's decision, but of course he is facing input from President Trump, J.D. Vance, Bernie Moreno. Everyone in the party is surely telling him who they want.
Sure. You mentioned the governor's race next year, and Dr. Amy Acton has mentioned that she has announced that she's going to run for governor as a Democrat. She, of course, led the Ohio Department of Health through the start of the pandemic. She left when she started receiving threats. Is it at all surprising that she would want to step back into the public spotlight to run for governor?
I don't think it's surprising. You know, she's become more active in Democratic politics in recent months. And of course, she was at the Democratic National Convention this past summer. And that was when she kind of first hinted that she was looking at a run for governor. She so far in announcing her campaign is really focusing on her experience as a doctor and her experience as an outsider to politics. Of course, she was the director of the Department of Health for a period of time, but she doesn't paint herself as a politician per se. So it's kind of why she's saying why she wants to run.
And who else is expected to run, Sarah?
Yeah, so for the Democratic field, it's kind of hard to predict right now. Of course, Amy Acton has a lot of name recognition in this state, and Democrats really don't have a huge bench. They haven't had a lot of success in statewide elections, of course, the last couple of cycles, most notably, most recently, with Sherrod Brown losing his seat, former Senator Sherrod Brown. But, of course, potentially Tim Ryan, Alison Russo, the minority leader at the State House, has been someone that political insiders have said is a possibility, but she's also keeping her cards close to her chest. On the Republican side, like I mentioned, Lieutenant Governor John Husted is, of course, a potential. He's already raised money for a potential run for governor, but if he takes a Senate appointment from DeWine in the coming days that really does take him out of the equation. Attorney General Dave Yost has also indicated that he wants to run for governor. He's not been very shy about it, and so I'm sure we're going to get a more official announcement from him. There are other, you know, statewide office holders like the treasurer and everyone who is really going to be playing a little bit of musical chairs, likely, among Republican statewide office. And again, Vivek Ramaswamy certainly could make a bid for governor on the Republican side. So it's definitely going to be a hot contest on the Republican side.
Well, in Ohio and Kentucky, lawmakers are back to business with legislative sessions that started this week. McKenna, in Kentucky, the year began with a disagreement over House rules. Tell us about that.
Yes. So lawmakers returned to Frankfort this week for the start of the 2025 legislative session. And one of the first acts of business before they can pretty much do anything in both chambers, both the House and Senate, requires adopting the rules of session. However, both Democratic caucuses in either chambers raised issues with the proposed rule packages by the majority of Republicans. And those packages, they say, stifled debate. And though they are a minority, Republicans had an easy time passing their version of the rules. However, on the second day of session, Democrats in the House tried to put forth their own rules package, and unsurprisingly, that was defeated, and business continued on.
Why do Democrats say these rule changes are such a big deal, McKenna?
Well, the rules are slightly different in either chamber, largely because of the number of seats in both of the chambers. There's a huge difference. But Democrats say that the rules were both aimed at stifling debate and silencing the minority. However, Republican leadership disagreed heavily with that. On the second day of session, when House Democrats put forth their own package, the GOP floor leader, Stephen Rudy of Paducah, said that the Democrats were attempting to undermine majority rule, which he said was the foundation of democracy.
McKenna, what do you expect the practical impact of these changes to be? Do you think it will mean less debate on the floor? It sounded like some Republicans were saying that that wouldn't be happening. Do you have any idea what the practical impact will be?
I think it would mean that there's more time to move bills through. This is a shorter session here in Kentucky. So this year it's a 30-day session because they're not considering the budget. Those are double the length. So there's less time to review bills, introduce bills, and debate bills overall this session. And with these bills, Republicans are hoping to streamline the process, but Democrats are worried that their voices are going to be lost in that process.
Sarah, in Ohio, one thing that seemed to go really smoothly was leadership elections. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it was definitely a change from 2 years ago. The expected happened. There were no surprises. So senators over in the Ohio Senate elected Senate President Rob McCauley. He'll be the new Senate president to succeed Matt Huffman, former Senate president, who's now Speaker of the House in Ohio. So, of course, Ohio has term limits, and Huffman was term limited in the Senate. So he ran for a seat back in November, and he didn't want to go over to the House just as a House member. He ran for Speaker, and he won the speakership officially on Monday. I guess they held elections. Wow, it's been a long week. And so really no surprises there. There was far less palace intrigue than 2 years ago when, of course, Democrats, all Democrats and some Republicans voted to elect former Speaker Jason Stevens as Speaker. A bigger number of Republicans ended up voting for a candidate, Derek Marin, who, of course, has since run for Congress and such. But there was a lot of drama 2 years ago, not so much drama this year. And, you know, McCauley and Huffman have worked very closely together because McCauley was kind of Huffman's right-hand man in the Senate. So I think over the next couple of months, you're going to see some legislation moving much faster.
And Sarah, what does House Speaker Matt Huffman say his big priorities will be this session?
He has several that he's outlined since he first won the caucus vote like a month or two ago. I would say a big one is school funding. He's expressed concerns with public education funding as of late. He's a big supporter of universal or of school vouchers, you know, giving money to parents to, you know, send their children to private schools or other sorts of schools. So I think we'll see some of that. He also was a big supporter of overhauling some of the state's recreational marijuana laws. So there was a big bill that passed in 2023. It passed the Senate, and the House never took action on it. It did things like limit home grow of marijuana, limit the number of dispensaries that the state could have, limit where they can be. It added like a public smoking ban. It did a bunch of different things, and it never really moved in the House. Stevens was not necessarily for it. He said there was too much disagreement in the caucus, but I think Huffman is really going to push for marijuana changes as well.
Do you think Republican priorities in the Senate will be any different from those?
I don't think so. I know another big thing that Senate President McCauley is talking about is taking on some energy policy. But I think everyone, leadership in both parties have really settled into this idea that there is going to be a lot more communication between chambers over the next 2 years.
Well, you mentioned the both parties. What are the Democratic priorities in the House or in the Senate? Are they very different from what you've outlined as the Republican priorities?
Obviously, you know, there are policy differences between the Democrats and the Republicans, and you've seen over the last 2 years serious opposition to some of these bills that relate to LGBTQ people. Democrats have taken a hardline opposition stance to those, but there is a lot of overlap. And one thing that I didn't mention that Republicans have said they do want to get done this year, the Democrats have been begging Republicans to take action on for months, are property taxes. The legislature really didn't pass any substantial relief on property taxes last legislative session. There was like a small expansion of the homestead exemption, but beyond that, really nothing was done. I think you're going to see some more movement on property taxes this year, and this is something that Democrats have really tried to shine a spotlight on because it just did not get much attention in the last GA.
McKenna, the League of Women Voters of Kentucky has raised concern about Kentucky's legislature and what the League sees as a real lack of transparency in filing bills. Does this seem to be persisting into this new session?
Yes. And this has kind of been an ongoing trend that the League of Women Voters have looked at. Ahead of the last session, they released a report that discussed all of the ways that bills are fast-tracked through the legislature and how that limits public input. And before this session, they looked again at that report and made some updates to it. One thing in particular that's become an issue for some advocates, but not all, is the lack of pre-filed bills. As I mentioned earlier, Kentucky's session this time is 30 days. And with the lack of pre-filed bills, that limits the time for some advocates to go through legislation that might be coming up and limiting their chance to talk with lawmakers and give feedback on proposals that will be coming up. So some advocates that I talked to, particularly those in the health space, use pre-filed bills to review a variety of health measures to give input before session starts. But then some other advocates that I talked to as well say that it's not the biggest priority for them in terms of legislative transparency, and they would rather focus on enforcing the rules of committees to review bills.
And McKenna, for people who aren't kind of living and breathing this legislative business every day, help explain what a pre-filed bill is.
Yes. So a pre-filed bill is simply a bill that is filed ahead of the start of session. In Kentucky, this previously meant that the bills would be filed, a draft would appear online, and it was all on one web page. So it was easily searchable, and you could see what lawmakers were proposing and working on as they prepared to return to Frankfurt. Now that the session has started, there are bills that are officially filed that are online, that are readily available online. Those get updated daily by legislative staff members. So it's kind of, it's a way for people to prepare for session and to kind of begin that conversation about what lawmakers want to discuss with the little time that they have to do while actually in session.
Yeah. And I imagine that's helpful for reporters, too. If you know what the bills are, what the priorities are going to be without pre-filed bills, does that mean you're just getting the legislation when it's introduced, both the media and other folks who are watching it?
Yes, it's definitely helpful, I would say, as a reporter to have pre-filed bills. But with that process going away, what we've seen are some lawmakers will post drafts if they're ready to share them on their own social media accounts or on their own websites, things of that nature, so they are readily available to view. It's not as accessible because it's not all in one place like it used to be. And also, we do see some lawmakers who bring things to interim committees, which those are the committees that meet while the legislature is not in session. And they'll share drafts of bills in those meetings, and those become available that way. Also, some lawmakers just share drafts of bills that they have with journalists and advocates as well.
Hmm. McKenna, we heard from Sarah about some of the legislative priorities in Ohio. Do you have a sense for what the big priorities are going to be in Kentucky, what you're going to be watching for this session?
Yes. The first thing that will be a definite priority when lawmakers return to Frankfort in February. With our legislative calendar, they take a little break between this first week of January and return next month. We'll see the GOP-backed income tax proposal, which would lower the state's income tax another 0.5%, putting it at 3.5%. This has been something that Republicans have done for the past several sessions, and with a goal of entirely eliminating the state income tax as with a steady drop. That bill has passed the House in this first week, and it will go to the Senate for a floor vote when they return in February. So that will for sure be a big thing to watch. Some other things, we're also seeing a lot of education bills that will be filed. One thing in particular are different measures to allow a handful of universities to offer new programs, such as the big one will probably be Murray State's opening a veterinary degree program, for a doctoral program to help with shortages of veterinarians in the state. So we'll see some movement on that for sure.
That sounds like a huge deal. That would take a lot of investment, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would take a lot of investment. It's something that's been talked about in the interim session, and even as far back as last session, I believe there was some talk of it, but nothing was officially filed. So we'll see some movement there. And then also, we haven't seen it yet, but we will probably see some measures on eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in higher ed when lawmakers return in February.
Sarah, is that DEI legislation something you think could come back in Ohio too?
Absolutely. I think it's all but guaranteed that it's going to come back. It really fizzled out in the House, similar to how the marijuana legislation was really held up in the House last year. And the sponsor of the bill, Senator Jerry Serino, he's a Republican. I remember him saying in November that he wants it to be Senate Bill number one. So it's absolutely coming back. I'm sure that there will be a long committee process and a long hearings process, because there are still a lot of opponents to this idea. But it'll be back.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau reporter Sarah Donaldson and Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley. Thank you both so much for your time today. It's been great catching up with you.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll hear how local journalists made the most of their winter weather coverage, and these stories involve a rubber chicken. This is Cincinnati Edition. You'll want to stay with us. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. So you probably noticed it snowed this week. Dozens of journalists across the tri-state had the job of reporting on the winter weather in the freezing temperatures. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about how they made the most of their coverage, our Local 12 news anchor, Bob Herzog. Thanks for being here, Bob.
Thank you for having me.
WCPO 9 News multimedia journalist Connor Steffen. Welcome to the program, Connor.
Thank you very much.
And WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy. Great to be here.
It's always great to have you. It's great to have you all here. We all know the snow hit us like a ton of bricks, and for news staff, that means trudging outside, reporting from the scene of the madness. I want to ask all of you where you were the moment you got the call, either literally or figuratively, from the boss to suit up and go out in the snow, and briefly, what was the story you were assigned to? Nick, I'll start with you.
Well, I was already suited up and out in the snow Sunday. My partner and I were hiking around the city. We were near Bellevue Park, I'll say that, watching the snow from a pretty cool overlook. And our boss, Marianne, was like, hey, can you do some stories? NPR won something. And I was like, yeah, sure. So we just found some folks who were making the best of the snow and talked to them. And yeah. By that point, there was kind of a lot of snow already, but it hadn't really, really hit. So people were still out doing some stuff.
So you were out enjoying the weather because that's just the kind of person you are.
Yeah, it's really good hiking and biking weather. Up to a point. Yeah.
What about you, Bob? When did you get notice that you were going out there?
So Friday, as I was heading out after we finished Good Morning Cincinnati, I got the sort of pull aside, like, we might put you outside on Monday. And I'm more or less an inside cat. And I was like, all right, if that's what you want to do. So I knew on Friday, on the Friday before, that I would be out on Monday. But then as we got into Sunday afternoon, it became, okay, what time am I going to head down to the station so I make sure I don't have trouble getting in for when we go on the air at 4 o'clock in the morning? I ended up coming to my office about 3 or 4 in the afternoon on Sunday with an air mattress and just sort of made like I was in the dorm room for a couple of days.
The air mattress life.
Yes. It's really highfalutin TV life, I'll tell you that. Yeah.
The glamour. I don't think people understand the glamour.
No.
Connor, tell us your glamorous story.
My glamorous story. I think it starts like last week when that forecast popped up. Like, I just knew I was going to be out in the weather along with a lot of...
Nobody had to tell you, huh?
No, you just knew. Monday, I tried to get my car out of an unpaved back parking lot where I live. I failed after an hour, so I had to be picked up for my assignment, which essentially was we were driving to Westchester, and then every so often we'd stop, we'd pull off, and we'd do reports on what we were seeing. So I think I made it to Westchester in about 3 hours. So first thing when I woke up, I knew exactly what we were in store for. And I both loved it and hated it, right?
Yeah. The love-hate relationship that is the glamorous business that we've all made our lives. Bob, you were presented with a rubber chicken.
And many local reporters, when they measure snow, they have a yardstick and they go, oh, there's that much snow. I'm not going to do that. If you happen to have a rubber chicken and you walk outside and you, with great force, throw the rubber chicken into the snow and it disappears, that means it's a lot of snow.
Bob, where'd that come from? Who thought that was a good idea?
I asked myself that question a lot in my career. So it was actually my assistant news director, Dave McMullen. He just handed me a yardstick and a rubber chicken. And I don't know if his initial thought was I'd just sort of use it as a clever measuring device and watch as the snow gathered further and further up the rubber chicken. I opted to go with a different technique where I just slung it into the snow because by that point, I think that may have been the second to last time I was on over that, 6 hour period or whatever it was. And I think I may have been a little over it by that point. And I just kind of flung that thing into the snow. But everybody, you all know this. If you're out doing that when it's coming down, you sort of run out of ways to say, hey, there's a lot of snow and maybe don't go outside. And so it was not the worst thing in the world to have something a little unusual to do, I guess.
Yeah.
I thought the rubber chicken test was the Associated Press's like preferred snow metric.
AP style. How many rubber chickens right. worth of snow have fallen in how much time?
I have to tell you guys, I just very quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt, Lucy. The number of people who said the lengths Americans will go to not use the metric system when they were commenting on the video, which I thought was hilarious.
That really is. I wonder how many centimeters long a rubber chicken is. That could be a follow-up. Nick, you met a woman who was grilling out. Tell us about her.
This person's a hero. it was in Over the Rhine, and we were walking, and I'm like, oh, I need a couple more people to interview. And I smelled the food cooking first, and I'm like, oh, somebody's about to have a really good dinner. And then I saw the grill, and I turned to my partner. I'm like, oh, I hope this person comes out. And then immediately after I said that, she came out. And I was like, hey, can I talk to you for a second? And she's like, yeah, sure. And she actually really likes grilling when it's cold because in the heat, you know, you get all hot and sweaty. And she's like, it's perfect weather for grilling. And I was like, yeah. I love this spirit. This is great.
And I'm not going to assume what stage of life that woman is in, but if she's in my stage of life, I can totally relate to the need to grill in the snow.
You know, Lucy, I didn't ask. Not one of the questions that came up.
I understand, and I think you did the right thing. Connor, you caught the spirit of people helping their neighbors. There were young people shoveling out senior citizens in Lincoln Heights.
Like I said, we have a lot of seniors in our community, so the young folks within the community wanted to go out, make sure that we shoveled out their driveways, shoveled their walkways.
Oh, it is just a blessing. It's almost like a miracle.
Connor, tell us a little bit about that story, and do you think snow events like this bring out these kinds of stories?
I'd like to hope so. I mean, I grew up in Cleveland, so I've been dealing with the snow for years, and you always see this. For me, what stuck out was you had a lot of teenagers. Basically, how this all started was this: the snow falls, there's 10 inches of snow, and this group, the Heights Movement in Lincoln Heights, knew that there was going to be a lot of elderly people who were stuck in their homes. So they sent out like a Google form, and a bunch of people fill it out. They end up doing more houses because, you know, word of mouth, they're out in this neighborhood. They say, my next door neighbor also needs help. But these teenagers took their snow day and decided, you know, without any compensation, really there wasn't anything in it for them. They're out in the cold. They just decided to do something for others, you know, to build a sense of community where they live. That was really what was really important to them, was that sense of community. It was great to see.
Yeah, yeah. Heartwarming on a cold, cold day. Nick, you know a thing or two about shoveling to help a friend in need, don't you?
I do. Yeah, yeah. I actually love snow shoveling because it feels like the kind of thing you would pay a CrossFit-like studio a lot of money to do, but you don't have to pay. In some cases, you get paid. I did not. But yeah, our esteemed politics commentator, is that the right term?
Senior political analyst.
There
Howard
we go. You with the titles. You always got the right titles. he needed some help with his driveway, and so my partner Celine and I went out. I have to admit, Celine did probably more than half of the shoveling, so props to her. But yeah, it was fun. It only took about an hour.
Wow.
We're available if people need it.
You're going to be so sorry you just said that on the radio.
Not if they pay me.
Bob, another thing about the snow is that it can drive us mad. And your viral video, which you called an anchorman's slow descent into madness, has literally been seen by millions of people at this point.
I'm having trouble breathing right now because it's both cold and I'm out of shape. And I'll throw in a third thing. Also, I'm old. Is it great snowman snow? No, man, no. I don't know where I'm going to go when we get all this snow. So you're either going to give yourself cardiac arrest or you're going to throw out your back. And by the way, it's sled riding and not sledding.
What's going on here, Bob?
Yeah, I don't really know. Again, when you put the inside cat, you throw him into the snow, you're going to get what you're going to get. But I don't know. In a sense, I almost felt like I was in the snow boots of the viewer, because I think when people are watching snow coverage, and I hear this from my two brothers a lot, it's sort of, it's snowing in Delhi, it's snowing in Batavia, it's snow. There's only so many different ways you can say it's snowing. And just to
I don't know, put a little creative twist on that, because you're still in the midst of almost what I would call the fun part of the snow. You know, you're not to the point where what streets haven't been cleared yet. And are people having trouble getting to the hospital? Are people having trouble getting food? You're still in the midst of, oh my gosh, we're getting a lot of snow, you know, and it's still kind of fun because we don't get a whole lot of really big snows like this around here. And so I tried to step into that. But at some point, the fun starts to turn to, it's kind of cold. And I've said the same thing 47 times now. So let's see what happens if I just say it a different way.
And you really took on a controversial issue with the sled riding instead of sledding. I mean, their newsrooms have fought over smaller things than that.
Yeah, I'm walking that same pop/soda line. You know what I mean? I had someone tell me, though, it's the same as I used to go bike riding. I never went biking. And similarly, I go sled riding. I do not go sledding.
Wow. Okay. Taking a stand here on Cincinnati Edition.
It's a bold move. Bold move.
A bold move for a bold man. We appreciate it. Well, I want to ask each of you, I'll start with you, Connor, best and worst thing about reporting out in the snow?
The worst is obviously just the actual feeling of reporting out in the snow. I mean, I know everyone listening doesn't know this, but I have a beard. So on Monday, there were like literal mini icicles forming on my beard. Well, I'm not reporting on this. That's the worst part. I think the best part is, for me, I got to meet a lot of different people who were just going about their day. You get to interact with a lot of people doing snow coverage. And they're always grateful, too, you know, that you guys are out there, that we're out there reporting. Well, they get to sit at home and watch. It's probably my favorite part.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I heard from Durant Daniels of the Heights Movement, and he said, you're always welcome back.
Tell him thank you very much.
I will do that. Maybe he'll hear you.
Tell him too, yeah.
Nick, how about you? Best and worst thing.
Oh, there's so many bests. The excuse to get out and ride my bike in some insane snow and talk to people about the snow is super fun, and seeing their reactions when I pull up on a bicycle, they're like, what are you doing? talking to people who are enjoying the snow, there's something about things like this that kind of bring people together. I feel like, oh, we're all experiencing this like kind of weird, unusual thing together. I think the least favorite was like seeing people who kind of had to be out in it and didn't really want to be. Like, there are a few people I talked to who are like, yeah, I got to shovel this for my boss. I'm not happy about it. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Those are maybe the indoor cats.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, Bob, it's your turn. Best and worst thing about reporting on this snow.
I think best for me anyway, I tap into almost the sense of what it was like to be a kid when you were going to have a snow day. Like, there's an element of that in it when it was still exciting and fun and you could be out in it forever until your parents said, you better come in or you're going to be, you know, frostbitten and everything else. And to just enjoy that a little bit that way. The worst part, I think, is thinking about the aftermath of it. You know, after you've slept on the air mattress for a couple of days here and you're thinking, okay, is it still going to be in such bad shape that I'm not going to be able to get home? And, you know, I've spent the last 6 hours telling everybody else not to leave. And the first thing when I do when I get off the air is get in a car, which I'm not sure is the best idea. So that could be a little rough on the back end of it, maybe.
Yeah. When you talked about aftermath, I really thought you were going to talk about sore backs and stuff like that from the air mattress.
Let me tell you, between that and going home and knowing there was going to be at least one section of the driveway that I was going to have to shovel, that was not looking forward to that. And neither was my lower lumbar, if I'm being honest about it.
Well, this has been great. One last question. Does anybody still put plastic bags over their socks before they put their boots on? That was like the go-to move in my childhood. Is that still happening anywhere?
I did 3 pairs of socks.
Okay. Okay.
Before I put on the boots.
Okay. Wow.
Kroger bags have many uses. That's all I'll say.
I went double socks, and then, you know, the hand warmer things you put in your gloves, they have ones you can put in like the toes of your boots now. Oh. And those are nice.
Okay. Got some pro tips there for everybody out there who's been listening. I've been talking with Local 12 News anchor Bob Herzog, WCPO 9 News multimedia journalist Connor Steffen, and WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you all so much for your time today, and I hope you have a warm weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you. Stay warm.
Up next, Who Day. At the start of this past season, it was more like Who Didn't. We'll talk about the Bengals. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. You know the chant, Who Day, Who Day, Who Day think gonna beat them Bengals? Well, early in the season, enough teams beat the Bengals that the hometown team didn't make the playoffs, despite a string of wins. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about what the heck happened is Local 12 digital sports reporter and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Thanks for being here. Okay, I have to tell you something about this. At the beginning of the season, I feel like I need to take some responsibility because at the beginning of the season on this program, I expressed doubt that the Bengals could beat the New England Patriots. I'm going to confess, I had no idea how bad the Patriots had become, but I expressed doubt, and then the Bengals lost that game. Skinny, is this whole season my fault?
Yeah, let's blame you. Why not? Because you know what? Everybody wants to shift the blame to somebody, and you know, Zach Taylor gets the brunt of it. Duke Tobin gets the brunt of it. But let's put it on Lucy May from WVXU. That sounds even better to me. No, if you go back to that New England game, it was kind of a convergence of a lot of things, unfortunately. They have been a notoriously slow-starting team. Some of that from mitigating circumstances. Numerous Joe Burrow injuries and maladies over the years, and his rookie year included when the COVID year. And this year, it was still the wrist wasn't quite right in the opener, and I don't think the Bengals knew how good the wrist was. I don't think Joe knew how good the wrist was, and they really didn't push things in the passing game that day, and Jamar Chase had the contract squabble during training camp, and things just weren't right. But you go back and you look and you go, that's inexcusable. It's the one game that was an extraordinarily winnable game, and that one game kept you out of the playoffs. That just can't happen again.
Well, because the Bengals were supposed to be Super Bowl contenders this year, and sure, some of the team's best players had terrific seasons, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you'd have told me you get the season you got out of Joe Burrow, Jamar Chase, Trey Hendrickson, you can't see any reason this team doesn't make the playoffs and then make a deep run in the playoffs. And honestly, if they'd have gotten in, they might have made a deep run. They were hot at the right time. They were playing extremely well. They were getting a little bit healthier, although they were banged up a little bit on the offensive line. But yeah, I mean, this is no longer a, boy, it'd be really cool if this team got to the playoffs. This team is in a window of trying to finish it off with a Super Bowl. And it looked like that's where this was heading in 2021 and 2022. And then the last 2 years, again, last year, the Burrow injury was a factor. This year, Burrow played all 17 games. Jake Browning didn't take but a handful of snaps, never threw a pass as a backup quarterback. So you can't use the excuse of Joe Burrow being hurt. And, you know, you saw at the end where, you know, assistant coaches are the ones that ended up paying the price for that.
Well, yeah, because Zach Taylor announced the firing of four coaches on Monday. First, is that a lot of people to fire all at once? And second, what kind of difference do you think that could make for the team?
Yeah, I mean, it's a scapegoat league. I mean, most sports are, right? I mean, it starts with the owner doesn't like what the GM's doing, he fires the GM. If the GM doesn't like what the head coach is doing, the head coach gets fired. The head coach is looking for somebody to point the finger of blame at. They're going to look at assistant coaches. And unfortunately, it was the defensive coordinator, Lou Anarumo, who I have a lot of respect for. You know, I think he was dealing with a tough deck when it came to personnel on his side of the football. But at some point, too, I mean, 6 years in, a new voice is not a bad thing. New ideas are not a bad thing. And when you haven't made the playoffs for 2 years in a window and when you're expected to make the playoffs, changes are going to be made. And you know, not just him, but Frank Pollock, the offensive line coach, who I don't think that was really a Zach Taylor guy. He had Jim Turner as his initial line coach. That didn't work out. I think this was an organizational move to bring Frank Pollock back. He was the offensive line coach the last year Marvin Lewis was here. And I don't think those two are ever on the same page. And then a couple of position coaches on defense, James Betcher, the linebackers coach, and defensive line coach Marion Hobby. And again, you know, look on the defensive line, they spent a lot of draft capital. They spent a lot of capital just in raw cash in that unit. And it just hasn't been a great unit. It hasn't developed. Some of the young guys haven't developed. And whether it's because of overvaluing them in the draft and maybe taking guys that are too high or higher than they should have been. Bottom line is, you know, when you're the coach, you're the one that's supposed to get the most out of them. And unfortunately, Marion Hobby couldn't do that. So that's why all those changes were made.
Well, how good a coach is Zach Taylor? I mean, how much of the buck should stop with him for this season?
Well, and that's where the next one goes. I think that's the crosshairs are on him for 2025. I mean, he made the move that he needed to make to kind of scapegoat the situation. And And so now it's on him. And sure, the head coach absolutely deserves some of it. I think he needs to unearth why are they getting off the slow starts. Is it simply as everybody points to a soft training camp? And most training camps anymore are really soft. I mean, there are older folks like myself that can remember the two-a-days in Wilmington, and they'd go in the sun for 2 hours and take a break and go in the sun for two more hours. And there was physicality and there was tackling. And then those all went by the wayside because the players union went, why are we beating each other up in training camp? Let's stop this. And so they did. And so training camps across the league are generally pretty soft. And, you know, people point to the slow start because of the way Zach runs camp. And I don't know if that's entirely true. It's an easy thing to point to. You know, he's 1-11. In his first two games of a season since he's been the head coach. That's something is amiss there. And again, some of it, again, is the Joe Burrow injury situation. But he does have to unearth and maybe take a deep dive into what maybe can we tweak a little bit. I know fans want to see the starters play in the preseason. I don't know if that's the answer or not. But if he takes the deep dive and says, okay, you know what, maybe we do need to get our starters some snaps in the preseason, he has to do something different. And so, yeah, the buck does stop with him. And clearly in 2025, if you don't make make the playoffs three straight years, despite taking them to a Super Bowl, despite taking them to an AFC Championship game, you are probably going to pay the price as the head coach.
Well, we've talked about coaches. Let's talk players. What do you think the future holds for Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins? Can and will the Bengals keep them?
That is the $64 million question. Actually, more than that, to be honest with you. I think Ja'Marr is going to get done. He's going to require a lot of guaranteed money. That's usually the sticking point with the Bengals. They don't mind paying signing bonus money. And I'll just use a round number. Let's just say he signs for $140 million. And let's just say $80 million of that is in the form of a signing bonus. And it's over 4 years. You can prorate that signing bonus into the salary cap in a 4 year, you know, $20 million, $20 million, $20 million. What players want, they want guaranteed money too on top of that. And the Bengals don't like to guarantee salary. Salaries in the NFL are not guaranteed. So when you sign a $140 million contract, and let's just say, we'll say 80 of that is base salary, the base salary is not guaranteed. So players, to their credit and agents, they want more guaranteed money. That was the sticking point this past offseason. That'll be the sticking point now. But now we're at the point where this deal does need to get done. And then you have to look and say, all right, what's the pot look like for T. Higgins? What money does he want? Does he want money that we just don't think is in our value range? He's a very good receiver, but he also has missed five or six games each of the last few seasons. He's had some hamstring injury issues. He has a history of that. You can't believe that that's not going to happen again, so you have to weigh that into it. And oh, by the way, Trey Hendrickson's in the final year of his contract coming up, and he's going to want an extension. I don't think it'll be a long extension, probably just add another year onto it, but that's going to cost you some money. And then you better hope you have a pot of money left over to fix some of the things you need, like a couple of guards, probably another defensive end, a defensive tackle, maybe a linebacker. There's a lot of things that you need to fix that you just can't fix with the draft alone. So it's a really important offseason. They got to find a way to juggle that money and make it work.
Well, and wide receiver Jermaine Burton is facing trouble. He was accused of assault late last month, although his accuser didn't press charges, and he's facing eviction from his apartment at the Banks. How important is he as a player to this team?
Well, I think they thought he was going to be. That's why they rolled the dice. There were a lot of red flags on Jermaine Burton coming out of college and into the draft. And that's why he's probably a first-round talent who slipped to the third round, and some teams didn't even have him on their draft board because of the red flags. The Bengals thought, okay, you know, they usually are pretty good at taking high-character guys. They chose this time to take a guy who's not of high character and thought, we'll coach him up. We'll make this work. He's just too good of a talent to not try to bring in. And it just didn't work. He didn't get in his playbook. He was late to meetings. You know, there was a time they were getting ready to play the Raiders this year. And on a Friday, they had him in the game plan. He was going to get some snaps. They had some injury issues at the time. I think he was hurt then, and they were going to use him. And unfortunately, he didn't take care of his business on Thursday and Friday. He was late to meetings, was late to practice. And so they made him inactive. And then at the end of this year, Zach Taylor called it a coach's decision. I don't know how much they knew of the assault that you spoke of. I'm sure that they did. I don't know if that played a role into him not being active for the Pittsburgh game. From what I understand, again, he was late to some stuff. And at that point, you've just run out of patience with the guy. So he was supposed to be important. And to the point of T. Higgins and re-signing him, you know, if you don't re-sign T. Higgins or can't, maybe it's just out of your stratosphere, you're just really down to Jamar Chase, and the rest of the wide receiver room is a real unknown. Andre Yoshibosh, I guess, is one, but he didn't have a great year. He had an okay year. So then your wide receiver room that you thought you were filling in the draft with Jermaine Burton is suddenly a little bit thin. And so, yeah, he was an important piece, but I don't believe he's an important piece any longer, and I'll be shocked if he's on this team when 2025 rolls around.
Do you think it's possible for this team to make the playoffs and even go to the Super Bowl next year?
I do. I do think that they have to hit on free agency to fix the guys. Like this past year, they didn't. They brought in Geno Stone to help the safety position. That didn't work. They brought in the veteran Von Bell. That didn't work. Sheldon Rankins was supposed to be a big help in the pass rush at defensive tackle. He didn't play a whole lot, and that didn't work. So you got to hit on these, and then they need to hit on some draft picks. When you're paying superstars in this league, you need to have guys on their initial four-year rookie contract who are performing, either starting or in a backup role, just to make the dollars work. And if you don't, then you got gaps that you try to fill through free agency, but then there's not enough money to fill all those gaps. And the last few drafts, they've whiffed in a lot of spots, and it's why they're kind of paying the price at the moment, trying to plug the dike, a finger here and a finger there and a toe here and a toe there. Enough team. Joe Burrow proved that this past year. I mean, he almost led this team that had a bunch of flaws on defense and a bunch of issues otherwise, almost led them to the playoffs.
Almost. Well, I'll try not to jinx them next season. I'll just say that.
Yeah, you go in with positive thoughts.
Okay, I'll work on my energy, my karma or something. I've been talking with Local 12 digital sports reporter and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Thanks so much for your time today, Skinny.
Lucy, thanks as always. Take care.
You too. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Her helper again today was her son, Dorian. Our technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.